Well, for the last several weeks, I've been talking about vision, and I tried to show you last week what my favorite French mystic, a guy by the name of Antoine, said last week. If you want to build a ship, he said, don't command men to gather wood, don't divide the work and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. All right? And that's because vision drives everything. And what vision does is it turns drudgery into delight, right? And it's not hard to get your mind around that. If I told you I wanted you to help me out with something, I had 2,000 letters that I wanted you to help me open, that would be a complete drag of a job, right? Unless I told you, well, in one of those letters, there's a $1 million check for you, okay? At that point, the drudgery becomes delight because you see the purpose behind what you're doing. Vision drives everything. Getting the right vision for your life or our church is essential. All right, many of us feel, all right, I know this, many of us feel like our lives are boring and pointless precisely because we've never caught the vision of what the Almighty God has intended for our lives. And I feel like that's in many ways what I do every single week, not just during, you know, this time, but I try to put before you a vision of who God is and what he wants from you, because that turns things in your life into a very clear purpose with a direction. All right, so I want you to live with vision, something that calls you upward. All right, today what I want to do is I want to bring this down one step farther for our church and then for you specifically as it relates to you. Let me tell you, first of all, a little story about our church for those of you that may not have been here for a long time. 2002 is when I became the pastor here at this church. It was at the time called the Homestead Heights Baptist Church. We met over on Holt School Road up in North Durham. And when they called a 27-year-old to be pastor, which was probably not well advised on their behalf, but they were desperate, I stood up, and in the first month that I was there, we had a church meeting, and I told about 300 people, which made up basically the entire portion of our church, and I said, I feel like we ought to change our name to the Summit Church, and they sort of went along with that. You know, they at least bought it, at least to my face they did. And then I told them that on Easter Sunday, we were going to have 1,000 people in church on Easter Sunday. That's what we were going to go for. You could feel the gasp in the room when I said that. I mean, it was like, because I mean, people were like, there's just no way. I mean, there's not 1,000 people who know Jesus in Durham, okay? There's no way we're getting 1,000 people in our church. And y'all, I'm telling you, I still remember a guy named Billy Turner, who is still, you probably here this morning at one of our campuses. I remember when he walked up to me on Easter Sunday, 2002, with a card in his hand. He had counted everybody that day, and he had tears in his eyes, and it said 1,134 people, right? And I remember him just shaking his head with a tear in his eyes, saying, I didn't think we could do it. And I was like, I didn't think we could do it either. I just thought it would be fun to try. Y'all, that actually did nothing for the growth of our church, because the very next Sunday, we went right back down to 450. But I feel like it did something huge to the psychology of our church, because I felt like God at that moment wrote something into our DNA that said, if you believe me for it, if you trust me for it, if you just open up and believe that I can do these things, that's what I will do. Last Sunday, we had just under 3,400 people at our different campuses in worship with us on Sunday. Right? I mean, who would have, in the words of my late grandfather, who would have thunk that? Right? And it's just, I mean, where did that come from? You know, that's something that God has done with us. 2004, that was when we decided that to reach our community, we needed to relocate from that place where we were to a place where we could expand. And so we raised a bunch of money, $2.8 million to be exact. It was actually double what we had tried to go for. We were shooting for about 1.5. And we used every bit of that money to buy 37 acres on T.W. Alexander Road in the Briar Creek area, not far from the place where I'm standing right now. They told us, the builders, that to get the permits to build on the land, that would take a few years. And they were exactly right. So in the meantime, we knew that it'd keep growing. We needed to open up a warehouse facility in Briar Creek, where I currently am standing right now. So for those at our different campuses, you're not there, but many of us are. 2006, that was when we embraced the strategy that we were here as a congregation, wherever we were, to bless our city. All right, that was when we really took seriously this whole Hope for Durham idea. It's expanded into Hope for Raleigh-Durham. We wanted to bless and serve our city. We simply didn't want to be a church that was in the city. We wanted to love and serve our city, to bring it joy, to restore its streets, to meet its needs. We wanted to serve our city and to meet her needs in such a way that we used to say, and we still say, that they would weep if we weren't here. Now, I will tell you this, by the grace of God, I think we are just starting to get there. Right, I got another letter from a public school principal this week telling me what a joy our church has brought to their school. I got another letter recently from a girl who said, I don't go to your church, but I work in the social services dimension of Durham. And she said, it seems like your church is everywhere. I'll talk to somebody and I'll tell them, I'll point them to your church. Or half the time she says they've already been contacted with that. And that's something I feel like is just getting started. 2007, at this church, we embrace what has come to be known as a multi-campus strategy. Right, and what I mean by that is that we have not one location, we have four campuses and three locations. And let me talk about this one for a minute because it's kind of new, and I know how everybody is with things that are new. It's always suspect. 2008 was our most fruitful year that we've ever had. All right, for those of you that are way out of it, that was last year. All right, 2008, we baptized 260 people last year. We did 140 of those in one Sunday. All right, our growth the last year was up 40%, sometime around 40%. 3,400 people last week was 40% up higher than what it was this time last year, which means that in the rooms, many of our campuses, it is a little uncomfortable, right? I mean, we all know that. I see people sometimes worshiping, and I just feel sorry for them because they can't raise their hands without knocking somebody in the face. You know, I swear one week I saw a guy worshiping like this with his hands. Because he was wanting to have his hands up, but he couldn't put them up. So it was just, I was like, all right, we got to do something. Here's what we are supposed to do. Let me tell you what we are supposed to do when we get in a situation like this. We're supposed to now build one huge, gargantuan building, right? So that it can fit everybody and everybody can come to it. But here was our thought in 2007. What if rather than just building one big, huge building and asking everybody to drive from all over the triangle to come there to that one church, what if we jackhammered that church and took it to the people, right? Instead of all the people coming to the church, let's take the church to the people and had one church that met in more than one location. There were three reasons that this looked really good to us. The first reason was stewardship, and that just means how we handle our money. It is a whole lot cheaper and more efficient when the venue is smaller. Right, there are a lot of those kind of venues available that you can rent, borrow, and buy. Right, they say, by the way, that a campus of that type usually recoups what you invest in it in 1 to 2 years. The second reason was evangelism. What I mean by that is, evangelism just means how we reach people. Churches work better when they are local. I mean, how many of you at any of our campuses have ever tried to invite somebody to our church? Right, and you come from like 35 or 40 minutes away. And you're like, it's so worth it to come 35 or 40 minutes. And they're like, drive 45 minutes to go to church. Are you crazy? Have you ever had that happen? Right? I know many of you have because you tell me that. We know that to be able to impact a community, you really need to be close to it. And so rather than one place that everybody comes to, you're like, well, let's take the church to where people are. So that was a second reason. A third reason was just the community of our church. There comes a point in an audience where it feels so big that you feel like you're lost. I know some of you are like, you know, you keep telling me to find my place in the church. I can't even find the bathrooms, right? Much less, this is the biggest church I've ever been a part of. Having smaller venues allows us to extend our reach while retaining our intimacy. I mean, you follow that? It allows us to keep growing and reaching people while retaining the intimacy that sometimes you lose as you get bigger. We want to reach tons of people. Let me say it like this. We want to reach tons of people in this church. I never want to stop. But we don't want to be just a mega church. I would actually rather be a micro church with a mega vision. Does that make sense? All right. So, what I just said a minute ago, I thought it was really good. I need to write that down. Something about retaining our intimacy. Somebody write that down, would you? Extend our reach and retain our intimacy. That's it. So we tell people, stay where you are, serve where you live, and be the church in that area. It's kind of like this. If God allows us to reach 10,000 people in the Raleigh-Durham area in the coming years, rather than having all 10,000 people in one place, why not have 1,000 in 10 places or 500 in 20 places, all right? Now, I understand, let me make this clear. Some of our venues will be large. We have a large venue here at Briar Creek, and we will stay the same. We have intentions to build a permanent facility here, as I will explain to you a little bit more in a moment. But in addition to that, we also want to, in addition to growing here, take the church closer to communities. In fact, I would say it this way. I don't want to build a monument with my life. I want to birth a movement that impacts all of Raleigh-Durham. And here's why. Guys, I have got one life to live. I don't know how long it's going to be, but I intend to like retire when I'm 90. I don't want to just build a big glass brick monument to Jesus. Because you understand this, I hope if you come here you understand this, it is not about buildings for us or graphs or anything. It's not about megachurch, it is about people. One of the things I love out of the series we just got done in Acts, I didn't get to get into Acts a whole lot. One of the things I love about Acts is Acts just goes back and forth between these huge macro pictures of what God is doing on earth, and then it'll shrink it down to a little itty-bitty story of a person. Trying to show you it's not all about numbers, it's about people. Right? My favorite communist, Joseph Stalin, said this. He said, the death of one is a tragedy. The death of a million, that's just a number. Right? So when you see numbers and you see things, you're like, yeah, what does that mean? It means individual people. I told you last week that one of the people that we have grown by in the last several years was a young future Chinese leader who came to our church, came to Christ at our church and is now headed back to China. I showed you another video last week of a guy who is in a nuclear physics program here at Duke, who came here just all into different religions and found Christ here. I got a letter a while back I've shared with you from a Carolina student who just said, I still remember, and I quote, the first day I walked into the summit in July of 2005, almost as if it were yesterday. I sat in the very last row, hoping to go unnoticed by everybody. Each week I came, I listened, and I left immediately. Finally, she says, in December, I laid down my life at the feet of Jesus and accepted him as my Savior. My life was still in pieces, but I rested in better hands. The Summit Church has now become my family. Right? I think of a guy named Ed Sue, who came here as a guy that was hooked on drugs. Came here, came to Christ, and now leads our Celebrate Recovery ministry we have to people that struggle with various addictions. And I've told you in the last few weeks of a family who came, a guy just released from prison, who came, brought his family, his five kids, and how different members of our church got involved in their lives and are now seeing that family growing together, thriving, getting their life back together. That is what I'm talking about, okay? At the end of the day, it's not about graphs and buildings. It's about people like that. And it's not just people, by the way, who went from, you know, one end of the spectrum to the other. We've got just things that are happening in our lives. I want to raise my children here, right? I want my children to know Christ. I had one of our elders tell me recently, he says, you know, I've just been in church all my life. He says, but in the last few years, my wife and I have grown more in the last few years learning about the gospel, learning about God's mission than we ever have in our lives. That is what it is. That is what it's about. I've got like eight other stories here. I don't have time to get into them. Friends of mine who came who were on the last leg of their marriage, and God used people in this church to heal their marriage, and now they're growing together and thriving, and they say it's altogether different. At the end of the day, y'all, it's not about numbers on a graph or building styles or sizes. It's about the stories of individual people, and buildings are simply a tool to that end. All right, so with that said, let me tell you kind of some things that are coming. Now, you're like, are you actually going to preach a sermon? Yes. This is just the world's longest introduction. Okay, so hear me out. All right, our goals, what we need to do, what we know we need to do to go forward. Let me just lay it out for you, all right? To go forward, we feel like we got to do three things. All right, and they are pressing and they are immediate. The first one is, and I'll just lay it out here for you like this, we got to do some current facility development. Right, and our goal here with that is to ensure that all of our current facilities are ready for growth over the next 1 to 3 years. There is no way that you can read that, is there? All right, well, just pretend. I'll tell you what it says. All right, to ensure that all of our current facilities are ready for growth over the next 1 to 3 years. All right, let me give you a little dilemma that we have had here as a church. All right, when we bought the property down on TW Alexander to build, the intention was that we would go ahead and build on it. So we started that permitting process. You ever tried to build something in a city like Raleigh-Durham? You know, I feel like, you know, we used to say that our goal was to make it hard to go to hell from Durham. I feel like their goal was to make it feel like hell to build in Durham. That's kind of how I felt about the process. We started the permitting process, and y'all, we just now got permission to go down there and actually build something there. All right, so we were planning on doing that in March. Well, that was all predicated on the idea that the bank would give you what they call a construction loan, which is where they're like, hey, you know, we know that you're good for it, so we'll loan you the money so that you can, even if you raise it all, you know, you at least kind of have it for a couple of years. That's called a construction loan. Now they're like, no way, no how, are you crazy? All right, you got to have 35% to 40% of that stuff in hand before we'll even talk to you. Which means that we know that to really do anything, it's going to take us at least a year of just concentrating what we're giving on that kind of thing right there. All right, so that means that if we do that delay a year, then if you take another couple of years to build, we're going to be in a lot of our current facilities for the next 3 years, right? Well, I've already told you some of the problems at our facilities is we're jam-packed, you know, and you just can't, you know, it's like a friend of mine says, how many pickles can you fit in a 10-pickle jar? 10, right? How many can you do it if you pray about it? 10, okay? There's just certain things that prayer don't fix. Right? So we're like, we got to do something. So we got to increase our capacity. Right? Part of that's at Briar Creek. Some of it is dealing with some things that are going on at our other campuses, which I won't get into. By the way, all this stuff I'll get more specific with in some different places if you're interested in hearing more details. Part of that is improving our technology. You know, for those of you that at the Briar Creek campus, if you can see me, it's not a big deal to you, but some of our campuses, they have a great video experience, but our technology is actually very, very limited, and we've got to upgrade some of that. One of the chief problems is I can't ever wear a dark shirt on stage, otherwise I look like a floating head at our campus. So I got to do pastels and light blues, which just doesn't fit with my personality. So, we got to do something so that it's more of a virtual experience. This is not about one campus, it's about all of them. Right, the next thing we need to do is we've got to actually look at doing a couple of new campuses in the next few years. We did a survey a couple weeks ago to find out where everybody was coming from. You know, we got these large numbers of people that are driving from different parts of the triangle, and our intention is what we need to do is we need to get some of those campuses started. You're like, where's the next one going to be? I don't know. I know we got some great prospects, whether it's Chapel Hill, Wake Forest, North Raleigh, Holly Springs, Mebane. There's a lot of places that we've thought about it, and we want to look at doing those things in the next couple of years. One of the things we'll do here immediately at the campus that I'm at is, in addition to having this venue, we want to be able to create another one. It would seat about 400 or 500 people that will serve as an incubation kind of place for us to launch a new campus from. That's how we're going to expand our capacity at Briar Creek, so we don't have to stack you up on top of each other. And I've already checked with Bill in the balcony here, and it won't work. That's the second part of it, is new campuses. Here's the third one, new facility. And here's what we say with this one. The goal is to purchase, to build, or to renovate a permanent facility to serve as a hub for, okay, a few key words in that. Number one, permanent, right? What we mean by that is we rent this place. We want some place we don't have to rent, right? Because rent is expensive. If you rent your house or you rent your apartment now, you know what I'm talking about. It's money you don't recoup. Now, I want you to understand, by the way, the original vision is the same of when we left Holt School Road several years ago. All right, when we left there, we ended up, again, having that thing. We raised over $2 million. And some of you are like, what did you do with all that money? Every bit of it went into a piece of property that we bought in Alexander, as well as to purchase the thing over on Coal Mill Road. Our plan is still to build a permanent facility to serve as a hub. There's your next key word. We want a hub for these three things: a church, a new campus training center, right, as we get ready to launch out other campuses. It's going to be a community ministry center for us, because part of our DNA is blessing our community. What does that look like? I'm not totally sure yet, based on whatever we buy or build. It may be a food pantry. It may be athletic fields for community outreach. It may be furniture and clothing stores to help assist people that are kind of down at a particular time in their lives. That's going to be part of it. And then a broadcast center. And what I mean by that is a place that I preach from that gets broadcast into the other campuses. It is a hub, all right? We're not like one mother church with a bunch of little itty-bitty kitty churches out around. What it is just a broadcast center where we grow and we multiply. To build, purchase, or renovate, that's a key phrase in there. And that means we will do whatever is the least expensive because buildings are tools enable to continue to pursue this vision that we're on. Okay, so that's kind of where it's going. Now, I know that raises questions for you. You're like, well, how much does each one of those things cost? In the coming weeks, you'll have chances, different meetings, to ask questions and to hear more about that. All right, but that's all. I'm just going to kind of give you the bird's eye view of it. Now, all right, why would we call this project Believe? Introduction is over. Here's the sermon. All right, why do you call this project Believe? John chapter 6, verses 5 through 9. If you have your Bible, I would invite you to open it there. All right, John chapter 6, verses 5 through 9. Take a look at this. This is the story where Jesus fed the 5,000. 5,000 men, add in the women and children. You're looking at 10 to 12,000 people that were there. This is the only miracle that is recorded in all four Gospels. Now, let me explain this to you as a guy who interprets the Bible for a living, which I know I don't always do it perfectly, but I'm trying to be conscientious about what I'm saying. This story, this miracle has some massive, what we call Christological implications. And what I mean by that is it shows you some things about Christ that I'm just going to completely skip over right now, all right? Because I want to show you something that I think he was also doing in addition to teaching us about himself. He was teaching us something about ministry. You see, the fact that it is recorded in all four Gospels indicates that it was to be a pattern to us for ministry, which is one of the reasons that I think all four Gospel writers included it in their Gospel. Verse 5, lifting up his eyes, John says, then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? Now watch this, verse 6, here's your key verse. He said this to test him because he himself knew what he would do. The key word there in this whole thing is in verse 6, and it is to test them because he himself already knew the answer. He was just seeing if they knew it. What kind of test was he giving to them? That's the question that that phrase begs, and here it is. The test is to see if they from then on would know how to respond to the situation of a starving multitude. That's what he's trying to test them to see. Because he's going to go back up to heaven. He knows that. Right? And he wants to know if from then on they understand how they're supposed to respond. Well, they gloriously failed. Scripture records in the different Gospels various responses that were given, but the general consensus among the disciples seems to be, we got to send them away. You know, I mean, they were smart. They got out their charts and their tape measures and their graphs and their, you know, algorithm charts, and they measured their capacity, right? And they just said, no, we can't do it. This is a bad financial decision. This is way beyond our capacity. One of the disciples said, offerings, Jesus, just have not been that good recently, right? And so we just can't do this. One of the disciples objected to the whole venture. You know, Jesus, I just really like it when it's just us for dinner. We haven't really spent any time together recently. When are we going to have some time for this right here? It's for us, okay? That was one of the responses. At least I think. I'm assuming it was. Jesus' response, send them away. That's what you guys are bringing to the table. I did not come into the world to send the hungry multitudes away. Right? You failed. Let me show you what I want to do. So they take an offering, right? And at the end of their glorious, huge offering, after they count it, right, it's 5 loaves and 2 fish. That's it. 5 loaves, 2 fish, otherwise known as a Hebrew happy meal, okay? So, can't you hear, by the way, one of the disciples, right, saying, I told you this was a bad idea. I told you this was a bad economy. People are stingy with their food, right? I knew this was ill-advised, right? Well, perhaps you know the story, and Jesus takes that little Hebrew happy meal, and he turns it into an all-you-can-eat calabash buffet right there in the middle of the desert, so much that there was 12 baskets full left over when he was done. Before Jesus got around to working here, there was a bunch of bodies, one around looking for food. After he's done, there's a bunch of food, one around looking for bodies to fit into, right? Now, if this really is a test for ministry, here is what I believe that it teaches us. You ready? Here it is. All that is necessary to complete the mission of God in the world is already in the hands of the church. All that God needs to complete his mission in the world is already in the hands of the church. The problem in every age is not that there is a shortage of resources, it's that we really don't believe that Jesus can do it, right? Here are two reasons that we are calling this project Believe. Here they are. Number one, because belief unlocks the power for the mission of God. Belief unlocks the power for the mission of God. I had what I will call a life-changing moment about a year and a half ago. And I don't use that phrase life-changing lightly because I think people use it way too much. You know, I watched an episode of 24 the other night, changed my life. Okay, no, you didn't. All right, it didn't change your life. You can't know that for at least a year out. Right? And you're not going to torture somebody, so it didn't change your life like that. All right? So when I say life-changing, I'm not saying that lightly. I had a legitimate life-changing moment. It was in a book that I was studying that walked me literally through every page of Scripture, right, and showed me how God's mission had always been to show off his power, to show that he was the only God worthy of worship. And what I noticed as I went through these different stories is that most people that experience the power of God in the Bible, catch this, most of them were not doing something that God had told them directly to do. Most were simply serving in the mission of God, and they saw an obstacle, and they believed God would overcome that obstacle. Right? Think of David and Goliath. Right? Here's David. If you know the story, got a 9-foot giant. David's like, 4'8". He's a little tiny 15-year-old kid. And here's this giant, and I can't find anywhere in 1 Samuel 17 that God says to David, now, David, here's how it's going to go down. You're going to go challenge the giant. The giant's going to say this back, and you're going to talk smack back to the giant, and then you're going to get 5 rocks, and then I'm going to take that second rock, and I'm going to bury the thing right in the guy's forehead. All right? And no, you won't find that anywhere in there. What you find is that David just steps into the moment and says, I think God will take care of this because I know what God's up to. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the Daniel chapter 3. We have no evidence, if you know that story, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the fiery furnace. You may have heard it in Sunday school. We have no evidence that God told Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego what was about to happen. They're just like, we cannot let everybody bow down to this Nebuchadnezzar statue and let that go unchallenged. So they stand up and they say, we think God will deliver us. And God does it. Right? You get to the life of Jesus, and what you notice is that many of Jesus' miracles were not done because he told somebody, this is what I want to do. It's people basically annoying Jesus until he heals them. I know that really is offensive to say it like that, but I'm overspeaking a little bit just so you can get the point here. Right? And one of them is the woman who comes up to Jesus. He's walking, somewhere, and she reaches out and touches his garment. And he turns around like he's surprised. Now, I know that he's almighty. I know that he knows everything, which means he wasn't really surprised. Right? He wasn't like, whoa, where did that come from? It means that he was trying to show us that the people that get the release of God's power are sometimes doing it where they come in and their initiative, they reach out and touch Jesus and they believe that he has power and the willingness to give that out. Does that make sense to you? And one of my favorite stories is where, the woman, the Gentile woman, Jesus is with the Jews, and here's the Gentile woman comes up and says, can you heal my daughter? And Jesus' response to her is the most politically incorrect thing ever been said. He said, woman, it is not right for me to take the bread that was intended for children and give it to dogs. Right? Now, I have found some commentators who try to argue that when Jesus said dogs in that passage, he didn't really mean dogs. He meant like a little puppy. All right? And then some other honest commentators who are like, no, he meant dogs. Right? And dogs was horribly offensive back then. He called that woman a dog. But she did not demur because she knew that he wasn't giving her a racial slur. He was talking about her worthiness. And she said, I got no problems with that. I am a dog. And then she made this statement. She said, but even the little dogs are able to eat at what falls off of the master's table. You know what she just said? She said, there is so much grace and power on your table that it just overflows off the table that even a little dog like me can have some. And she said, it's not about my worthiness. It's about the power and the extent of your grace and your power. And Jesus said, you get it. And you got your miracle. And that was the life of Jesus. Paul, you get into the book of Acts. I've explained this before. I cannot find any place that God told Paul to go to Rome to plant churches. But he knew that Rome was a capital of the world. First time it's mentioned, Acts 19:21. Paul heads to Rome. It's Paul's idea to go to Rome. He just simply said, I know what the obstacles are, and I think I want to go to Rome, so I'm going to say I'm going to Rome, and let's see if God can get me there. Right? By the way, if you ever look in your Bible, right after the book of Acts closes, the next book in the Bible is Romans. Right? God took him there. But see, this is exactly what you have here in John chapter 6. Right? There is a test to see if we realize that God wants to feed the multitude and take a chance and know that all that he needs to do it is already in our hands. Y'all, I feel like when I realized this about a year and a half ago, it just released me to begin dreaming, not just for this church, but for my own life. Where is it that I need to see the power of God, that God is waiting on me to step up and say, God, I know what your power is in this situation, and I believe it. I suddenly felt like I looked at ministry, I looked at the Bible, I looked at our church, it just changed the way that I looked at everything. The analogy that I use is one that I was also about a few years ago, I heard this story that I think perfectly gives you a picture of it. I heard it as a true story, but a lot of stories I hear are told to me as true, and they're really not. But this one, I don't know if it's true or not, but it was a story of some American servicemen. Let me back up a little bit. The Japanese newspaper carried a story. I saw it in an Indonesian newspaper. The Japanese had picked up a group of sailors who were floating in the water off the coast of Japan, holding on to the remnants of a ship. And when they got them into the boat, The Japanese Coast Guard, these guys were complaining that a cow attacked them from outer space. So they thought, okay, these guys are probably drug runners. They're probably taking some of the drugs. Let's put them in prison until we figure out what happened. All right, so about a week later, a group of American servicemen kind of sheepishly came forward and said, we might have an explanation to what went down here. And so here's basically what happened. We, on one of these islands out not far from Japan that we have a base on, we were taxiing our big, like, B-1 bomber or whatever down the runway. And in the middle of this runway, all of a sudden walked a cow, right? And we thought, man, this would be awesome. We'll take this cow and we'll get to the next place that we go to and we'll, you know, have some steak dinner tonight. So we put the cow in the bomb doors, in the bomb bay area of the airplane. And we got up to about 30,000 feet and the cow just started to go ballistic, went crazy, was bouncing off the walls. And we didn't know what to do. So we did the only thing that we knew how to do. And that is we just opened the bomb doors and dropped this cow from 30,000 feet. So here you get this little group of Japanese fishermen, right? You know, they're kind of, they're chilling out. All of a sudden they're like, you know, they're looking up and they're watching this thing, this cow fall from outer space and it hits their boat and destroys it. Is that true? I have no idea, right? But it suddenly gave me a picture of how I felt like I read the Bible all my life, right? I feel like we got these little like ambitions where we're just kind of doing stuff. Like we're like this cow, you know, just kind of, we're chomping on some grass here and chomping on some grass here. And you're like, man, you're in the middle of a runway, right? You have power. There is power in the middle of this runway that you got no idea, right? And you either better get on board or get out of the way. I feel like there is a highway going through history, all through the Bible, where God is showing off the power of his name, and it's simply when you believe it, right, that God begins to release his power. And what I want you to do is I want you to buy into this mission. Because, y'all, I want you to hear this. It is not about a man, a band, all right, or a business plan. Yes, those rhyme, right? It's not about any of that stuff. It is about a vision. A vision and a mission is what God will bless. I had one of the older members of our church, you know, in their 40s. I had an older member of our church who told me, he said, you know, I thought his words were so poignant. He said, I got one life. He says, and I don't want to spend, he goes, I don't want to spend the rest of my life building a monument. I want to spend it leaving a legacy of the church to my children. I don't want to build a monument. I want to birth a movement. Yeah, and I don't have any problem with what other churches have done and how they've done it, but I don't want to just say, let's build a big, you know, glass Raleigh monument for Jesus. You know, because, you know, we're always, well, we'll do it for our kids. What we end up leaving our kids is a big, huge, empty, out-of-date building and a mortgage the size of the national debt. Right? I don't want to just build a monument. I want to birth a movement, and I want it to be right here in Raleigh-Durham. Now, y'all, you understand, I can't guarantee you that I'll be alive tomorrow. So I cannot control, you know, what's going to happen to me in the future. But my plan is to retire here. I've told you this before. I plan to preach my own funeral service in this church. Get down off of the stage, get in the coffin, shut the lid, say hi to Jesus. That's how it's going to go down, all right? My retirement date is set for 2038. Through the grace of God, I want us to leave a movement and a legacy of church planting in Raleigh, Durham, and all over the world. All right, here's the second reason we're calling it Believe. And that is that Believe tells us how to behave when obstacles seem overwhelming. Believe tells us how to behave when obstacles seem overwhelming. All right, that's what this story teaches us. You're like, but we're in the middle of a recession. That's what people tell me. Why not wait? Why not wait to go forward? I totally understand that. Right? And that certainly means we have to be prudent and to show caution. But guys, here are my thoughts, all right? First of all, when are we not going to be in a recession, or when are we going to get out of it? Right? I mean, our president said yesterday that he thinks it's going to take years, not months, to get out of this. Right? Second, there is no moratorium on hell during a recession. Right? There's no like, oh, you know, okay. The mission of God goes on. Third, when has a recession ever stopped God? Acts chapter 2, you realize this, it started, the whole church started in a recession. These people are having to sell their property so they can feed each other. Right? God did just fine in Acts. Right? Just like in this story, 5 loaves and 2 fish is an economic recession. I don't know what God is going to do, but I can tell you one thing he does not do. He doesn't get up every morning, check the stock market, then decide which of his marvelous works he can afford to pull off that day. Right? Jesus has a mission today, and he provides today what we need to do today. That's where we go back to that story of the manna in the Bible. And I realize if you're kind of new to church, I'm referencing a lot of stories, and some of you may get lost in this. But the story of the manna was they're out You know, they don't have any food, and so God provides every single night enough food to get them through the next day by just having it fall on the ground, all right? And what that teaches us is that God provides enough for us today to do what we need to do today, right? And you see, listen, the church acts differently in a time of recession than everybody else, because everybody else is like, we got to sit on our resources. You know, we got to sit on our resources. We got to not budge, not move, and we got to hold up because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And God's people say, well, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow either, but we know God's going to be there tomorrow, and we know that he has a mission today, and he's given us today what we need to do to obey him and follow him today. Right? So we act differently in a time of recession because we know that Jesus is there. Right? I know that he will give me today what I need to use for the opportunities today, knowing that he will be there tomorrow. In fact, by the way, the story of the manna teaches us that if we try to sit on it and stockpile it, right, then it all goes bad. Right? And then remember the story? It's like you try to hold it up and not obey me today, it'll all go bad. Right? By the way, the story that we're looking at in John 6 is followed by the story of Jesus walking on the water. Right? Matthew tells it, you know, and John tells it just a string of saying, he's saying, trust me. Here you got the disciples, you know, and they're in the waves, and they can't see how to get over those waves. And then all of a sudden, somebody's like, wait a minute. Isn't there somebody, can I make out a figure walking on the water? And it's Jesus, right? Now you imagine when they talk to Jesus, imagine if one of the disciples had been dumb enough to say, wow, were you scared out there? And Jesus' response would have been, you know, it looks altogether different when you're sitting on top of the waves than when the waves look like they're over top of you. And what he's trying to do is teach them that when the waves seem like they're about to overcome him, you look through the fog and the mist and the storm and the chaos and you see that there's a figure walking on top of the waves. All right? I gotta move quickly here and end this up here. Let me deal with a few things that I know some of you might be asking. You're like, I hate this. It's all about money. You know, I hate this. It's about money. This is why I don't come to church. I understand why you feel like that. Honestly, I feel like I'm pretty cynical by nature. Even though, you know, I do what I do, I'm pretty cynical. I don't know how to answer that for you to tell you that Veronica and I, my wife and I, have been wrestling with this for quite some time because we've known this is coming. You know, we are certainly invested in our church because, you know, it's my job, and if it fails, then I lose my job. But that's not really the entire reason. She and I have been praying through what God would have us to do as a part of this. And we've been looking at ourselves really as the first, you know, kind of givers. And we've been on this journey for a month. And I'll share more with you in the weeks to come. But God has done the way he has worked in our lives. He's put his finger on some things that we loved, you know, and said, this is what I want. I want this right here. And then my wife, who is one of the most giving people that I've ever known, you know, points out to me some things that we were doing for her that she says, she goes, I want to give up something I love for something I love even more. And that is thinking about what God will do here. God put his finger on ways that we could sacrifice in our lifestyle and give. You know, the verse that we couldn't get out of our minds was 1 Chronicles 29, I will not give unto the Lord that which costs me nothing. And so we're like, we're going to give until it affects our lifestyle. You see, guys, listen, I believe in the story of the two mites. You know, Mark chapter 12, where there's a woman who has two pennies, literally, is how you translate that. And she puts one of them in, and Jesus said she gave more than everybody else. Her penny gift did not affect the bottom line at all, but he knew that it represented her heart and soul. What I know is that God, what he wants is our heart and our soul, right? I want you to believe in this, not as a way to raise money, but because you believe in it, because your life is in tune with what God is doing. And I want you to give your heart to the mission of God and not to the silly things that we all live for. And when that happens, I know we won't lack anything. And by the way, let me just tell you this loud and clear. Right? There's going to be no compulsion. Right? You're not a part of this church, or you just resent this kind of idea. Right? If you don't give because you love it, don't give. Right? There's no compulsion in this. It's not what God needs or wants. But there's a group of us that believe in this and buy into it and just love what we're about to see. By the way, that also brings up another objection. Some of you may be thinking, you're like, Pastor JD, I'd love to, but I just don't have anything. You know, I mean, economic recession has hit me hard. I totally hear you. I had this thought this week. You know, I was reading this article. It talked about the 60th wealthiest foundations, philanthropic foundations in the United States. And it showed me what they gave their money to. It was an article on Slate. Right? The most wealthy donor last year left almost her entire estate, almost 5 $5 billion to a foundation to further the healthy treatment of dogs. Now, I'm all into the healthy treatment of dogs, okay? She left $12 million to her dog, right, is what she, and I'm just like, God. In fact, I look in the list, only one out of the top 60 had anything to do with a gospel-centered mission. And my question to God was, God, why did you give all the money to some people and all the vision to the other people? Right? Put them together, you know? I don't know. But I know that one of the reasons is so the glory would go to God when it happens. And I guess that's why we have stories like John 6 in the Bible, so that when it gets done, you say it's not about a wealthy donor. It's not about wealthy people. It's about what God can do. For those of you that are in the midst of, you know, you're like, I don't have anything. 2 Corinthians 8:12, a verse you rarely hear pastor preach on. 2 Corinthians 8:12 says, you cannot give what you do not have. Okay, so I understand. You need to understand that you are released from that. And I don't want to put that kind of pressure on you. In our last time we did this, we had people who sold cars and houses, gave away savings accounts. Some who did things like giving up their cable so that they could be a part of this. It's about your heart. That's why we call it believe. All right, let me apply this to you personally real quick, because I want you to understand that this applies to more than just a project. You need to see Jesus on the top of your personal waves. I know some of you right now are in the midst of overwhelming circumstances, and you're like, God, where are you? Are you powerless? And I'm telling you, listen, you can't be excited for us what you haven't seen in your own life. You need to start by trusting God with your issues. You think God doesn't care. I would tell you, look at the cross, because that's where God proved how much he cared about you. You think, well, God can't help me. He doesn't have the power. You look at the resurrection where Jesus walked out of the grave. A dead man walked out alive. And you'll see the extent of God's power to help you. All right? All right, you're like, well, what do we do next? Well, in the coming weeks, you're going to hear more about the details. And you're going to have a chance to ask questions. I want you to go home and start thinking about this. I want you to go home and start praying about it. But for now, what I need all of you to do is I want us as a church to begin to get engaged together. When you go out today, all right, your family is going to receive a little thing that looks like this. All right, it is called Believe. All right, Believe is going to have, it's got all kinds of stuff in it. It's got daily devotionals that we'd love for you to do together as we take a spiritual journey together. It's got small group resources that your small group is going to be using. All right, in addition to that, it's got some stuff about prayer. We're going to organize a thing called 1,000 Hours of Prayer here at the Summit Church. We want you to be a part of that. We are going to pray our rear ends off, all right, in this. And I want you to, the details are in here. One of the things is called a Day of Hope Project, all right, a Day of Hope. What we're going to do is in one day on February 15th, we are going to make an offering to our community. And we've identified the things that we feel like that others have told us our community needs most, all right. And you'll find a list of those in that book. All right, now here's what I don't want it to be like on February 15th. Now catch this. Thank you, Brandon. All right. I don't want it to be like when you go to the fair, that canned food drive, you know, where you show up with your two cans of green beans and lima beans and you get into the fair free. All right, I don't want it to be like that. Right? This is not that kind of thing where we're throwing a token thing at our city. Like I've told you before, we give them a turkey at Thanksgiving and flip them the bird the rest of the year. That's not what this is about. All right. I want you to listen. This is part of our DNA, and God help us if we presented this thing as if it was all about us. So we're doing this huge offering. All right, what I did is we went out last night and I bought $40 worth of groceries right here. That's all these bags. You catch these right here? $40 worth of groceries. That's what it costs Veronica and I to eat out, because she always gets really nice stuff when we eat out. All right, so that's what it costs us. All right, that's what I want you to do. I want you to not throw me a couple cans. We went out, we bought nice stuff, $40 worth of groceries. We're going to have a semi parked out in front of some of our campuses and U-Hauls, and we just want to fill that up. And you can see the organizations we're going to give it to, who we partner with. In addition to that, you'll see something about giving clothing. All right, I'm giving this the theme, the coat off our back and the food off our table. All right, food off your table is the food, the coat off our back. This right here is what, this is my nicest coat. Listen, I want you to hear this. I don't want you going home and getting your members-only Faded Glory jacket you wore back in 1980 when Michael J. Fox was in Teen Wolf and Wham was the hottest group out. I don't want that one, all right? I don't want that. And it's not, we don't want that. That's not. I want you to give a coat literally right off your back. That's the coat I wear all the time, Right? And I'm like, you're like, well, what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to go out to go out and buy another one, or I'm going to wear one of my old ones that I have, you know, tucked in the attic or closet away somewhere. Right? I want us to give. I want us to give of our heart and soul to our city. So don't bring that junk in here. Right? You bring your best. Right? And we're going to put it down here, and I'm doing this first, okay? So it's my nicest jacket. It's from Wilson's Leather, okay? It's a leather jacket. I'm putting that, and if I one day see a homeless person walking around Raleigh throwing that thing on, I'm going to cheer and clap and say, that's what it's about right there. Because this is us taking Jesus to our city. That's what's going to come. All right? That's what's coming. You'll get that when you leave. Finally, let me just say this, and I'll close. I'm going to turn it over to our worship teams. I know some of you guys, especially if you're new here, you're like, oh, I totally came on the wrong Sunday. Okay? I understand that. I understand that. I really do. But I hope what we're doing makes a statement to you, though. Because I've heard it said that the value you place on something is shown by what you'll give up for it. Right? I am calling on the church to extraordinary sacrifice, and I hope that if nothing else, that shows you the extraordinary value that we place on the gospel. Why? Because we believe there's no other message by which people can be saved. The only thing that fulfills and satisfies, we know, is Jesus. And people come here with all kinds of problems. Their marriages are falling apart. They're hooked on drugs. They're struggling with depression. But we know, listen, we know that sin is the real problem behind all the other problems. And Jesus is the answer. Most of our problems stem from the fact that we are separated from God. And Jesus can restore you to God and fill your life with meaning. I've heard it said that the church's message is basically one beggar telling other beggars where to find bread. We are beggars at this church, but we are feasting on Jesus, the bread of life, and we invite you to feast with us. And I want you to see that we would give our lives and our resources to help you see the truth of that. And I hope, if nothing else, that's what you see through this process, okay? All right, that's all I can say. Why don't you bow your heads with me, and I'm going to let our worship teams come up at our campuses and lead us. Father, for the prostitute in our city who has not yet found redemption in Jesus Christ. Father, for the skeptic who has not yet found the assurance of faith in Jesus Christ. God, for the broken marriage that hasn't yet found the healing in Jesus Christ. God, I pray that you would extend the vision and the resources of our church, that we might be able, Lord, to do exceedingly abundantly above all we would ask or think. God, we yield ourselves to you, and we ask in Jesus' name. In Jesus' name, amen.